Hello, everybody. Josh Brown here, back for another great episode on Franchise Euphoria. Well, today's episode is brought to you by IndieFranchiseLaw.com, a leading resource in the franchise space to help you if you're considering buying a franchise, turning your business into a franchise, or growing your business through a licensing or franchise structure. So go on, check it out, IndieFranchiseLaw.com. I think you'll find a lot of valuable and free information as you continue to kind of weigh franchising and licensing and the growth of your business. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy today's episode. So on today's episode, I'm thrilled and excited to have Casey Cohen, who's a bankruptcy lawyer that I've known for many years here in Indiana. And I specifically invited him on to talk about bankruptcy restructuring and how to deal with a crisis like we're dealing with right now with COVID-19. And he was gracious enough on very quick notice because of the timeliness of this topic to jump on a recording with me. Casey is one of those guys that he's incredibly good at his craft. He's smart, he's savvy, and he's also an entrepreneur himself. So as you're listening to this, I want you to know, like, he's owned businesses, he has different interests now, and he's also an exceptionally good lawyer in working with businesses and people in restructuring the nature of their businesses when times are rough. So without further ado, I hope you enjoyed this interview with Casey Cohen. Hello, Casey. Welcome to Franchise Euphoria. How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's awesome to have you on such short notice. We were just had reconnected again on LinkedIn, but I've known you for a number of years now. You're a fantastic bankruptcy and restructuring lawyer here in Indiana. And as we were talking, I thought, man, this is would be really timely and I think great information for franchisees and franchisors to have you come on the show, talk obviously a little bit about yourself, your history, but then really dive into, in these unprecedented times, what folks need to be thinking about. I mean, obviously, bankruptcy is not something that, you know, I'm trying to encourage, but I am trying to encourage folks to be thinking about all the different opportunities that are available to them and ways in which they can work around their situations to try to avoid certain outcomes. So we'll definitely dive into that as well. But before we do, give a little background on yourself. And, you know, you've been doing this for a few years.
I have. This would be my 36th year in the bankruptcy practice here in Indianapolis. You know, I try to tell the youngsters that the best way to start a bankruptcy practice is to have a background in accounting. So my undergraduate degree is in accounting, and I actually wanted to be a tax lawyer when I was graduating from law school because I had that little personality at that time.
Some evolved later than others, but apparently your personality evolved after law school.
Well, I had the good foresight to become engaged to a woman who is the exact opposite of me. So that helped tremendously.
That's great.
So a couple of things about my practice that I think may be interesting to listeners. Number one, I am an entrepreneur. I have run a handful of businesses over the years, and I can tell you that in no small way, my practice has contributed to the success of those ventures. Because what I do primarily is look at business models that are broken in some fashion. But the entrepreneur piece means, number one, I am not a big firm lawyer. In fact, to the contrary, I have practiced entirely by myself without staff or an associate or a partner since 1992. So long time. And what that means is that I have had to embrace and leverage technology in my practice. And I think that's relevant to a lot of businesses.
And made adjustments. I mean, it made adjustments over time, too.
Well, as technology has evolved, if you count backwards from 36, I was around when the PC came out. I was the first lawyer in our office that had a PC at my desk.
Wow.
So the tools that existed back then were nothing compared to what we have today. So yeah, it's been an evolution over that period of time.
Were you always involved in, I mean, from the get-go, because you said you wanted to be a tax lawyer, have you always done bankruptcy type work, restructuring, working with, you know, businesses on figuring those issues out?
Yes.
Okay. You know, this day and age is unprecedented. I mean, you know, we're in the midst of COVID-19. The entire economy has been forced shut down, quote, temporarily, but I say quote, because nobody knows what that means, right? Nobody knows when we're going to turn on and what that really means too, because I think what we're realizing as we all work through this is just because, you know, the government or somebody says, hey, let's all get back to work. I really think what's going to happen is obviously the health crisis component of it's going to dictate. And if people don't feel like they can safely go and do so, they're not going to do so on a large scale. And there's an additional risk if they do so that this thing rises again. So obviously those are components that nobody can predict, nobody can know, and nobody can sit around and say, okay, you know, this is the exact day where we're getting back in business. So you've got a whole bunch of businesses, tons of franchises everywhere. I'm talking to people every day about this that are in a holding pattern. And of course, you know, we've got the Paycheck Protection Program and we've got other loans, SBA loans, disaster loans, other things that I've talked on recent episodes and that I think we're all at least relatively aware of to help get through this. But from the perspective of the modeling of a restructuring, of a bankruptcy, you know, you're seeing businesses that have broken down in some way, and now you're taking a look at them and you're saying, okay, can this be pieced back together? Should it be pieced back together? Or should it just be, you know, liquidated and gone? I'd love to kind of hear your perspective on all of this, both from the bankruptcy perspective and from your entrepreneurial experience.
Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind when you couch it that way is that your listeners need to consider what the effect of this event is on their future. And that may seem like a ridiculous understatement, but is your industry part of the future or is it part of the past that we have now just embraced? So when you're paying attention to things like the comfort level that people have with going back out in public and engaging with various types of businesses, I think everybody who listens to this podcast really needs to ask themselves, am I part of that? Is this business going to be a part of the future? We know, for example, that restaurants are going to come back, right? Everybody's going to wind
for sure.
up going, yeah. When, of course, that is probably the last business that's ever going to get populated again because of the nature of in-house dining.
Yeah. And what's that going to look like? I mean, they're already talking about when they go back, is it going to be something where there's mandates against, you know, trying to keep 6 feet away? And do you just work in booths versus tables? And, you know, what does that do in terms of your space? Now you're utilizing, you know, half of your space or less than that. I mean, there's all sorts of questions regarding that. But you're right. People at some point are going to flood back out to these restaurants.
Yeah. So that piece, I think, is part of the future. Now, this is probably not relevant at all to franchises, but an example that is really on my mind is what happens to the office world after we have learned how to run our businesses remotely, which we are all forced to do right now. Do we really return en masse to an office? The answer has to be no. It just has to be no. Now, again, I can't think of a franchise application of that concept outside of course, the famous one that we just saw in the paper yesterday, WeWork.
Yeah.
They're going to start defaulting on contracts. They're stopping payments to landlords. That's the core of their business model. So I think they're starting to realize this business model really doesn't have legs in the future.
Well, I would say, though, is, you know, to further dive into that notion, you know, I think a real application to this, to the franchise model, you know, obviously it's going to have an impact on the brick and mortar folks. You know, what does the future design of the restaurants look like? What does the future design of the business look like? Is there going to be more of a focus point on the takeout, the delivery, lowering of the overhead, and not having, you know, perhaps as much space? But even beyond that, even beyond the restaurants, just looking at the concepts where they're just factoring in office space. Is that necessary anymore? Right. You know, does that present an opportunity? I think it presents a great opportunity for franchisors to set up their models in a way that becomes less onerous for franchisees to get in. You know, doesn't require as much upfront capital, but still, if they're a good model, has the back end benefit. Because I agree with you. I mean, you know, it's funny. You and I are probably similar on this. I mean, I've worked remotely for not fully, but, you know, as I've chosen to for years now. You know, I've been set up to where I can work remotely. I have an office. I go into the office. But if I decide to work from another space or out of town or at home, I can do so. Never have I had to do it or done it to the consistency and extent that we've all been forced to do it right now. But I'll tell you this much, Casey, I kind of like it. I got to be honest with you. I mean, you know, first of all, I see my family more. Right. Second of all, I find myself working out consistently more because I'm in an environment where I can control that element a little bit more. And I find that, you know, it has helped me in a lot of different ways. But I'm fortunate that I live in a house, I have space, I have an office area that I can go to. You know, not everybody obviously has that, but I agree with you that I think that's going to be a huge impact. I've already thought about ways in which once things sort of go back to normal, how I'm going to tweak how I work and where I work from so that, you know, it works better for, you know, how I want things to set up. Of course, I miss seeing people, right? I mean, you miss the interaction, but at the same time, I think what a lot of people realize is that, boy, I'm in my car a lot, driving around to, you know, meetings all the time. And some of these meetings, frankly, could just be done through video chats.
Absolutely.
Just sometimes more effectively, you know?
Sure.
I mean, do you look at that as a way, I would guess in terms of like with what you do, I mean, does the entrepreneur and you look at that as a way that if you're looking at a business, if you're looking at a franchise and they're talking about different changes and opportunities to restructure, perhaps there's an opportunity to take a situation like this, a crisis like this, and perhaps restructure, maybe not in the bankruptcy sense, but just in terms of the modeling sense of the actual franchise to make it more adaptable to the future?
Oh, I think that is an absolute ingredient for success for any business going forward. You have to take this as an opportunity to rejigger your model and make sure that it is adapted to the future that we are discussing right now and whatever evolves from it. Because, Josh, as you know, we're only in a couple of months here. Who knows what this thing is really going to look like?
Yeah.
And I don't want to get political or get involved in what anybody can go out and see on the YouTube right now, which is the raging global debate over where it's all heading. But I think one thing we could probably agree on is it's not going to get there real fast. Going back to the restaurant conversation, when are you going to feel comfortable going into a room full of people having a meal? It's when there is a vaccine, when you know if you get it.
Yeah.
Or if you've taken the vaccine that you can't get it. That is clearly something that every business has to think about. And how long is that going to take? We keep hearing 12 to 18 months. What I've read about it suggests that that is still a realistic window. So if it really takes that long, you know, businesses have to consider what that means to their operation. They do have a really nice opportunity here to restructure.
Talk about that. I mean, what does that mean? Because for you, you've lived in this for 36 years. I know a bit about what you're talking about. But for the average person, there's a whole lot of misinformation about what restructuring looks like, bankruptcies, all that kind of stuff. Can you just break that down?
Let's do that with a wonderful little piece of allegory. The reason I became a bankruptcy lawyer is because that's what my dad did. And the old man had a great little story. He said, if you owe your banker $100,000, your banker owns you. If you owe your banker $1,000,000, you own your banker. What does that mean? What it means is we are all in this together, folks. Your creditors need you as badly as they need air.
I've never heard that, but I've never heard that framing of it. That resonates really well because they need those loans to not be defaulted on.
Right.
They need you to work through that process.
Yeah. And when you know, at $100,000, you're not going to hurt the banker and he doesn't really care. And he's probably just going to wash his hands and walk away from you. But at $1,000,000, he's got to pay attention. So what that does is cast the relationship in an objective light, if you will. So the point I'm trying to make to people listening to this is don't feel powerless. And also, I think what we have here is an historic opportunity for debtors and creditors to get together in a way that they never did before. Another allegory, going back to the beginning of my practice in the early 80s, mediation was not a word, Josh. There was no such thing. And the whole concept of talking to opposing counsel on the phone was somewhat foreign. It really was not that common. But as we evolved over time, and you put it in the context of today's practice, you would never do a case where the first thing you did wasn't call opposing counsel, feel it out, see if there's a way to fix the problem. I think that under these circumstances, that kind of environment is ideal for both sides to any transaction. And the parameters of the conversation that you can have with your landlord, with your key vendors, with your employees, all of whom are creditors of the business, is entirely different than it was 3 months ago.
How do you approach that? How do you approach that conversation?
Well, I just keep the basic theory that I laid out in mind, which is we need each other.
Yeah.
I need you to make a deal with me so I can stay in business. And on the other side of that coin is the exact same consideration. I need you to make a deal so you can stay in business. I don't want to really overburden that point, but an example, something that I invented years ago. Okay, well, maybe I didn't invent this. I'm not Al Gore. But I always advise my residential landlords to work with a tenant rather than evict, to the extent that I will say, look, if you go give them a couple $100s, you know, I am a residential landlord. So when I've got somebody who can't pay and we know the deal's falling apart, if I go over and say, hey, get all your stuff in a truck, move on to the next place, I'll give you a decent reference, and I'll give you a couple $100 on the way out the door. I just saved a bunch of money, trust me. Because if I fight them and I go through an eviction proceeding, I got to pay a lawyer, I got to wait for a bunch of time, they're going to be mad, the house is not going to be in good shape when I get it, my appliances are going to be gone. Go make a deal that actually makes sense and get everybody to cooperate. I just don't think you've ever had as fertile an opportunity as you do right now for that to happen. So to any business owner, do not hesitate to pick up the phone and talk to anybody that you owe money to. I guarantee you they are going to be flexible under these circumstances.
Do you think there's opportunity to, and maybe, I know this is on a case-by-case basis, but obviously, you know, the opportunity is, okay, what's the relief that I can have right now? But perhaps that lends itself to a bigger question, a bigger conversation of what that relationship looks like going forward beyond this. Because again, I mean, to your point earlier, and I think it's a very relevant point, is that I think some people are under the notion that, you know, okay, in May or mid-May or whatever, you know, you just sort of flip a switch and everything goes back to normal. And it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen that way. And I think you have to, that's not being a Debbie Downer negative perspective, but you have to have some reality around the situation. You can't, to your point, people aren't going to feel 100% comfortable till there's an actual vaccine out there or something that they know, okay, if I get this, I can take this and I'm going to be okay.
Right.
And so can you use a time like this to contact your banker, contact, you know, the credit card companies or any other creditors? So listen, I want to talk about right now, but I also want to talk about 6 months from now.
Well, I think that's part of the conversation, right? If I'm going to say to my landlord, look, I have a 98% reduction in top line revenue because of the situation. Give me 3 months of free rent or put 3 months at the back end. That's how you make that deal work. So you are talking about both the current situation and the long term.
What do you think about landlords or creditors who are offering, you know, I've seen this a lot with landlords where they might be offering deferments, which is not, there's a difference between a deferment of your rent and an abatement of your rent. If you're talking about the abatement of your rent, it's now foregone. It's not going to be due. It's okay. Right. Over these next 2 months, you don't owe rent. And, you know, there's an argument. I'd be curious your take on this, right? There's an argument that I could craft where that makes a whole lot of sense, right? I mean, the business isn't operating. You're not getting the benefit of the bargain. It's not your fault. It's not the landlord's fault either, but it's not your fault. And to the extent your business is operating, my guess is you're operating at 25% capacity. So you certainly shouldn't be held to the full rent, even if there's a deferment. You know, if you're at 25% capacity, maybe you agree to pay 25% and it gets deferred over time. What's your take on getting the full abatement or getting some portion of it abated versus a deferment where, okay, I'm not going to charge you the amount right now or over the next 60 days, but you're going to owe that money back sometime between now and the end of the lease. Or as you said, we'll add it on at the end of the lease.
Right. My take is that that is a perfectly fair exchange. That if I'm getting the benefit of deferred rent as the tenant, then I should not resist agreeing that, hey, maybe down the road, I got to pay that back. Because I don't think the tenant's position in the conversation is, hey, landlord, I don't want to pay you. It's, I can't. And we all know why. So I don't know that I would approach those conversations by suggesting I just should never have to pay this to you. I just can't do it now. And then as things spin out over time, you can reevaluate that. If you have agreed to defer your rent and post it at the end of the deal, you'll be overjoyed if you make it those 3 years, won't you? So I don't think that's a bad way to approach that.
That's a fair point. I mean, in our remaining time here today, because obviously, you know, we've got to have an abbreviated conversation for purposes of that, but I want to provide as much valuable insight and input for folks, knowing full well that when you're looking at a bankruptcy, when you're looking at a restructuring, or when you're looking at these various options, it's very fact specific, right? I mean, it depends on your situation. It depends on a whole lot of things. But the idea is to get the conversation started. But let's say somebody has gone down that road. I mean, let's say there's no possible way right now for them to continue. You know, they're waiting on getting money from the feds that's not coming fast enough. They can't continue to keep their employees. They can't continue to pay everything. You know, what are sort of the next steps then that they need to look at? Because I think part of the angst is not knowing what the right next step is. I mean, is the right next step after that, you know, call your bankruptcy lawyer, call Casey, you know, and see what's going on?
At the moment, the answer to that is affirmatively no. And the reason is nothing is going to happen in the next 90 days. If you default on a lease, you fall behind on a vendor agreement, or God forbid, you're in default under your franchise agreement. I don't think the counterparties to those agreements are going to do anything in the next 90 days.
Or it better be a damn good emergency of mammoth proportion, because you're going to have to answer to a judge about that, right?
And that's the whole point. The reason is because a creditor knows if they file a collection case or an eviction suit, judges aren't going to pay attention to that right now. It's just going to get parked. You can't even go into the federal courthouse right now for a bankruptcy hearing. I'm not sure what the story is at the city-county building for state cases, but my guess is it's the same thing. You're never going to get in front of a judge. So on the tenant side or on the franchisee side, keep that in mind. Let's not freak out and try to reach for some solution, because I think you've got 90 days where absolutely nothing is going to happen. I think what you should do when you're even talking about bankruptcy, first and foremost, is make sure your own house is in order. You and I, Josh, know each other because you have sent me clients who are dealing with a failing franchise. And my job is to give them bankruptcy advice. The first thing I do to anybody who comes across my telephone line is talk about their personal situation. And it's amazing, even today, after all these years of this being fairly common in the practice, you know, we all know that the franchisees have guaranteed their obligations under these agreements. Every lease is personally guaranteed. Most of the major vendor contracts are personally guaranteed. So you have to know what that means to you.
Yep.
Don't hesitate to find a bankruptcy lawyer. That is something you can do right now. Get on the phone and talk through your situation and find out if there's things you can do to prepare yourself to defend your guarantee. Absolutely critical. And most people just don't think about it until it's too late. When somebody comes to me with a complex personal financial statement, a lot of the things that I'm going to recommend that they do will work immediately. But then some of the bigger things that we have to do to put that personal financial in order have waiting periods before they become effective. Transfers are always subject to Most states have the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, which gives creditors 4 years to look back at transactions. So get in and see your personal bankruptcy lawyer now.
Yeah. So in other words, if you're trying to avoid, I mean, this is in part what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. If you're trying to avoid being liable for various things and you've got a personal guarantee, it is not a wise decision to start transferring funds, setting up new companies and trying to escape that way, because there's a 4-year look back. And at some point in time, somebody's going to come back and look back and say, okay, what have you done during this time frame? Correct?
I would not say it's necessarily unwise, but it certainly may not be.
Okay.
That is the beauty of what your bankruptcy counsel can share with you. What's going to work? What's not?
Perfect.
Yeah. So that's number one. Number two, make sure that your corporate house is in order. This is a great opportunity to sit down, look at your financial statements, and think about the relationships that they reveal. So first and foremost, when I look at my long-term liabilities, I'm going to see my banking relationship. Again, that brings up in my mind ideas about your personal guarantee, but it also brings up ideas about what exactly is the relationship with that lender. Do they have an interest in collateral? What is that collateral worth? And what am I going to need to be doing with that collateral to keep my business alive in the future that may or may not be in the best interest of the bank? And the reason I bring that up is because a lot of times when I meet a new client, first of all, they're usually clueless about that relationship. Can I see a copy of your loan agreement and any correspondence that you've had with the lender? I get a blank stare about half of the time. It's not written in stone that your lender has absolute control over everything that they think they do. So it's really important to investigate that relationship and understand exactly what it is. That would be something with respect to a secured creditor. Everybody understands the vendor relationships are primarily unsecured. Those are accounts that are set up that contemplate credit. That's the whole idea. The vendor delivers, they send a bill, you've got a period of time to pay it, 30, 60, whatever it is. And in the meantime, you owe that vendor the money. Those relationships are entirely different than the secured creditor relationship.
Yeah, because with the secured creditor, you're talking about, you know, you have some collateral that's securing that loan, you know, it being your house or something else or accounts or something that's of significant value that they can get to by way of your default, whereas unsecured or, you know, credit cards, other stuff like that, they don't have that.
Exactly. And those relationships become strategic. They become things that you have to think about. Generally speaking, a business bankruptcy can be evaluated as follows. Creditors are entitled to receive the value of their collateral under a Chapter 11. Now, that may seem like a simple sentence, but that really, if I was going to say one thing about Chapter 11, that's what I would say. So what does that mean? With respect to secured creditors, it means, again, you've got to take a good look at A, the list of their collateral, B, the value of that collateral, and C, whether or not they are properly secured. There is a very strict, under the Uniform Commercial Code, secured transactions take up an entire section. It has to be done right by the creditor or they lose. And in Chapter 11, we have a provision in the code that's called the strong arm provision that I use to set aside imperfect secured transactions. If there is some failure by the secured creditor, I can take advantage of that in Chapter 11, set aside their interest in collateral. And that's huge.
I mean, does that happen quite a bit? I mean, I know you can't give a percentage, but does that, you know, for the average person, they might be thinking, oh, that probably doesn't happen very often. My guess is it probably happens more often than people think.
It happens all the time, Josh, all the time. I have a case right now. I probably have a dozen different secured creditors. It's a weird business. But out of that dozen, I'm just thinking right now, I think only three of those creditors got their documents put together correctly.
So the other nine aren't going to get anything?
No. They're not. I want to add a caveat to that basic calculation. If you're entitled to the value of your collateral and you have no collateral, the bankruptcy code gives you one little step up, and that is you have to get more than you would get in a liquidation case in order for the debtor to confirm a Chapter 11 plan. So what that means is we have to promise to pay unsecured creditors something in order to get out of Chapter 11. More than what they get in liquidation basically means something more than zero. And I have confirmed cases where we put a nominal amount of money on the table, say $2,500 to pay $100,000 worth of claims. Wow. So relatively small dividend.
And this is in the restructuring of the business. So that they're going to, so that they're going to come out of the Chapter 11 and actually be an ongoing enterprise with a clean slate at that point, as opposed to if they're looking at a Chapter 7, which is just full liquidation, you know, of all of the assets. So Chapter 11 would be a, you know, you're essentially going in trying to get a clean slate so that you can be on ground level, not below it going forward, right?
That's exactly what Chapter 11 is. For the benefit of your listeners, let's address something that you just brought up, which is, do you file a Chapter 7 for your business? In 36 years, I think I've done that maybe five times. The answer is probably no. And I don't want to, you know, make any bankruptcy lawyer who's listening to this mad, but if your bankruptcy lawyer is telling you you need a Chapter 7 for your business, you might want to get a second opinion. It accomplishes virtually nothing. So keep that idea in mind, the Chapter 7, for you personally. There are huge benefits to a personal bankruptcy if more than half of your debt is non-consumer. So most of the guys that I'm talking to that are franchisees meet that test. Because by the time you add up their guarantee obligation to the franchisor, the landlord, and the secured creditor, it's bigger than their home mortgage. It's bigger than their car loan. And as long as that's the case, then you are treated as a non-consumer Chapter 7 debtor. And what that means is your budget is irrelevant to your discharge. There was a bunch of press back in 2005 when the bankruptcy code changed to attempt to force more people to file a Chapter 13 case as individuals. And the way that was done was by limiting your budget to essentially something that is vetted by the Internal Revenue Service in terms of the members of your household and your average expenses, what they should be based on IRS statistics. Obviously, that's not very generous and you can't make much money. Some entrepreneurs, you know, that are going to need to file bankruptcy based on the failure of a franchise or otherwise, you know, they'll bounce back pretty fast. Because you guys are experts at your field and you have run a business and you know what it takes to keep things going, you become fairly attractive to employers down the road. And I think a lot of guys that I talk to who have run businesses do pretty well in their second lives.
Yeah.
The point is that that can happen before you file bankruptcy, and it's ideal to do it that way. I won't talk about that at length today, but you don't ever want to file bankruptcy personally until you absolutely have to, which means you are protecting an asset or your income, which means that a creditor has gotten so close to you that they're about to take those things away.
Yeah.
Everybody understands when you have a judgment against you, first of all, most people don't realize this, but a creditor can freeze your bank account without notice if they have a judgment, and that creditor can also garnish your wage. When one of those two things is about to happen, that's when you file bankruptcy. But you don't file the day you close the store. You just don't need to. So my point is, keep in mind that if your business debt exceeds your personal debt, you can always file Chapter 7 regardless of your income.
And when is, I mean, you kind of touched on this earlier, but just when is a, for people who are thinking through all this stuff, I mean, when is the right time to contact a bankruptcy lawyer just to ask about these things? I mean, is the right time after that they've tried to negotiate a little bit, they've, you know, they're not getting anywhere, or is the right time earlier than that to kind of formulate a strategy and figure out, okay, here's my secured creditors, here's my unsecured creditors, here's the strategy we're going to do to try to work this out?
The right time is as soon as this podcast is over.
Okay.
Yeah. It really is. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You may call somebody and he'll ask a few questions and, you know, because I will do this on the phone for anybody. And that probably makes me a bit unique. Don't expect that from the lawyers you call. But when you get to have the conversation, it's not complex. You know, I can walk through your personal financial statement with you on the phone in 2 or 3 minutes and tell you exactly, you know, what your exposure is. Here's some things that we could change so that you're in a better position. It's really not very complex.
And are you limited in your, are you limited in your practice to Indiana?
No, not by any stretch of the imagination. I can practice in any bankruptcy court in the country.
Okay. All right. Well, what is your, thank you so much, Casey. Obviously there's so much to dive in. I wanted to purposely kind of, you know, address a few of these points and get people thinking. I think we've definitely achieved that. What's your contact information? Best way for somebody to get a hold of you?
Just surf to smallbusiness11.com.
Smallbusiness11.com?
Correct.
The number 11 or spelled out 11?
You know, Josh, for the $12 I spent at GoDaddy, I got both of them.
You know what, Casey? I knew you were a smart guy, but that just reinforced it for me.
Yeah. It makes it so much easier. I started a tech company back in the 90s, and I use an email address that has that company's name, which makes no sense to anybody who asks me, what is your email address? So I've learned the hard way that you really want to use one that you don't have to repeat to somebody.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, listen, Casey, I appreciate it. I know we'll talk more offline. Really appreciate you on short notice sharing that. This is really, really valuable information for a lot of people who are experiencing this right now. So we'll get this up in short order. And thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Josh, thank you. And to everybody listening, best of luck. Hope it works out.
Thank you so much for tuning in for another episode of Franchise Euphoria. If you enjoyed this episode or have enjoyed the podcast in general, I would really appreciate it if you could go to iTunes and leave me a rating and review. It really helps to get this podcast out to more and more people. So the easy way to do it is go to iTunes and in the search box, put in Franchise Euphoria. You will then see my cover art and you click on my smiling face that says Franchise Euphoria and then click on the link that says ratings and reviews. It's that simple, but boy, oh boy, does it mean the world to me when people leave ratings and reviews. And like I said, it really helps get the show out there. Once again, would love it if you would go to iTunes and leave a rating and review if you enjoyed this episode or other episodes of the show. And until the next time, happy franchising.